Ferris B'nai Torah presents The Shmooze, an engaging and motivating Musar and Hashkafa series that deals with real-life issues.
The food this evening is sponsored by Avram Chaim Rutenberg and David Simai. At the very end of Moshe Rabbeinu's life, almost one of the last addresses that he speaks to the Jewish nation, he says, part of the address, he says as follows, Zechor Yemos Olam, remember the days of yore, Binu Shnos Dor Vador, study, introspect about the years of generations, Sha'al Avicha Ve'agedcha, ask your father and he will tell you, Zekinecha V'yomer Lach, your elders will recount for you. Basically, this is part of the rebuke, part of the Musar that Moshe Rabbeinu is telling over to the Klal Yisrael, that you didn't pay attention to history. And Rashi says what this means is, Binu Shnos Dor Vador, study the years of each generation, Lo Nesatem Libchem, you didn't pay attention Al She'ovor, on that which passed. Binu Shnos Dor Vador, study each generation, Lahakir, to recognize, Lahabo, to the future, She'esh Biyodo Lahetiv Lachem, that Hashem has the power, the capacity to help you, U'lahanchi Lachem Yemos HaMashiach, and to bring you to the days of Mashiach, Volam Haba, and the world to come. So basically it seems, according to Rashi, that Moshe Rabbeinu's rebuke to the Klal Yisrael was that you didn't study history. Had you studied history, you would have seen that Hashem is mighty, Hashem is powerful, Hashem has the capacity to bring you to the times of Mashiach and to bring you to Olam Haba. And again, what Rashi seems to be saying is that history, studying world history, specifically Jewish history, will bring a person to a very strong sense of emunah, sense of strengthening their belief system, and from that they will see Hashem, and they'll see that Hashem can and will deliver them. And the only problem with this Rashi is that l'chora, it sounds very difficult. Because typically, when we study history, and specifically Jewish history, what comes out are many, many questions. And the first question that typically comes out is, how could Hashem allow it to happen? How could Hashem allow us to be destroyed, to be persecuted, oppressed, generation after generation? And if anything, typically, studying history brings up many questions, isn't a strengthening of our belief, it's quite the opposite. And yet Rashi seems to be very clear about the fact that Moshe Rabbeinu was saying that if you would study history, if you'd binu shnos dor vador, look into each year's, each generation's accounts, you would see a great chizik, you'd be strengthened in your emunah, and you'd see that Hashem is mighty, powerful, and has the capacity to bring you to the days of Mashiach and Olam Haba. And the question is, what's pshat? So I'd like to see if we can understand this Rashi a little bit better this evening. And let me begin with a very interesting story that's actually an anecdote. I don't know if it ever happened, but here's a story. Adolf Hitler began his rise to power speaking in the beer pubs in Bavaria. And if you know much about the history of the Nazi Party, it began as a very fragmented, tiny, minuscule little thing. Typically, he would speak at one of these meetings and it'd be a few hundred people gathered, most of them ill-educated. And the story is told that at one of these meetings, Hitler is going on ranting and raving, the misfortune of Germany is the Jews are the reason we lost the war, it's either the fatherland or the Jews, and I choose the fatherland, on and on for an hour. When he's done, the entire audience leaps to its feet in adoring applause. And in the back of the room is a noticeably Jewish man, an older man, and Hitler sees that along with the rest of the audience, he's clapping. And after everyone mills out, Hitler walks over to this old man and says to him, "Don't you think I was serious? Don't you think I meant what I said, that I intend to rid Germany of the Jews?" The old man, undaunted, looked up to Hitler and said, "I believe you. I believe that you meant every word that you said. But you must remember, we're an old people. Many, many centuries ago, there was an evil king, Pharaoh. He oppressed our people, enslaved them, and God saved us from him. And in honor of that salvation, we have the beautiful, beautiful holiday of Passover. The family gets together. It's a wondrous time. many centuries later, there was an evil king, Haman. He wanted to kill us out when God saved us from him. In honor of that occasion, we have the beautiful holiday of Purim, festival, merrymaking. Centuries after that, the Greek Syrians tried their hand. When God saved us from that, in honor of that occasion, we have Hanukkah. But Hitler, you hate us far more than anyone else. And when God saves us from you, what a holiday there'll be. There is no holiday that marks Hashem saving us from the Nazi regime. But despite the all-out systematic attempt by then, the most powerful nation on the face of the planet, to wipe us out, we are still around. Despite the fact that they did everything in their power to try to kill us, we are still around, discussing, existing, still as vibrant as ever. And it's a rather interesting and curious fact. For the 2,000 years that we've been in exile, as a nation, we've lived through every imaginable torture known to man. We've lived through crusades, Spanish inquisitions, blood libels, pogroms, persecutions, mass murders, gassings. If ever there was a method known to man to torture another man, no one understands it was used on the Jews. If ever there was a diabolical means of killing another man, it was used on the Jewish people. And historically, we were stabbed, shot, hung, executed, clubbed, burnt, gassed, and beaten to death. History shows that there's no shortage of creativity when it comes to killing Jews. And ironically, we're still here. We're still around. We're still around. And the ultimate irony is that while we celebrate a Pesach because Hashem saved us from Paro, we celebrate a Purim because Hashem saved us from Haman, and we celebrate a Hanukkah, whilst we celebrate that, our enemies are no longer. The great Egyptian Empire, the Romans, the Persians, the Babylonians, anyone ever hear of them recently? They had their moment of power. They were strong. In their might, they too tried to vanquish the Jew, and they are no longer. And one of the ultimate ironies of history is that the mighty, powerful nations that surrounded us, that attacked us, that stood over us generation after generation, are no longer, and we are. And the reason why I think that's very important is because oftentimes a person says, listen, I would love to see the hand of Hashem. I would love to daven better. I would love to be a stronger mamin, but it's very difficult for me to see Hashem in operation. And gentlemen, I present to you that if a person wishes to see the Yad Hashem, they need go no further than just open a page of history. Study any event that has happened to us, read the events, read the stories, and what you'll see is over and over overt and clear miracles. A tiny little nation being driven, being oppressed, and time after time, somehow it is that they continue to exist and their mighty oppressors are no longer. And I think what a person sees when they look at that is they see Hashem protecting his nation, guarding his people, bringing them from exile to exile, always ensuring the fact that this nation will not be annihilated. But maybe you say that's my perspective because we're frum, and that's a Torah perspective. And what I want to share with you is I don't believe that a person has to be religious nor Jewish to share that vantage point. And I want to share with you a number of quotes from secular historians who have no Jewish background and certainly no religious agenda, and yet it's a very similar conclusion that they reach. And let me quote for you something. There's an article written called The Jewish Dispersion by Leszczynski, and these are his words. For 1900 years, from the destruction of the Second Temple to the establishment of the modern state of Israel, the Jewish people have wandered literally around the world. This wandering was usually precipitated by intolerable spiritual and or physical persecution. The scope of the Jews' 1900-year exile is reflected in the lands from which they were en masse expelled. And now Leszczynski is going to do us the courtesy of telling us which lands we were expelled from. And he begins. For example, in the 3rd century, they were expelled from Carthage, North Africa. In the 5th century, from Alexandria, Egypt. In the 6th, from France. In the 7th, from the Visigothic Empire. In the 9th century, they were expelled from Italy. In the 11th, from Mainz, Germany. In the 12th, from France. In the 13th, from England. In the 14th, from France, Switzerland, Hungary, Germany. In the 15th, from Austria, Spain, Lithuania, Portugal, Germany. In the 16th, from Bohemia, Austria, the Papal States, Netherlands, Ukraine, Lithuania, Oran, North Africa. Get it? It's a world atlas. If you count the nations, the countries that we were kicked out of, you read the entire world atlas. In fact, I have a little challenge. Go on a nice sunny day, downtown Manhattan, stand in front of the UN building, and look at all the beautiful flags unfurling in the wind. Find me a flag of a nation that did not persecute us, that did not kill us, that did not expel us. And the only flag that you'll find is a flag of a nation that didn't exist when there were Jews there. Because without fail, it is a part of history that the Jews land in a country, have some peace there, and within a very short time are either murdered outright or expelled. And ironically, has anyone recently heard of the Visigothic Empire? That was where we were kicked out of in the 7th century. We were kicked out of places that no longer exist, that no one heard of, but we still exist. The ultimate irony, they, the powerful, the mighty, are no longer. The powerful Greek Syrian dynasties, the most powerful nations, stood upon us, and you cannot find them anywhere today. Here's another quote. Leo Tolstoy, who was no friend of the Jews, my friends. He wrote an article entitled, What is the Jew? What is a Jew? This is not as strange a question as it would first appear to be. Come, let us contemplate what kind of unique creature is this, whom all the rulers and all the nations of the world have disgraced and crushed, expelled and destroyed, persecuted, burned and drowned, and who despite their anger and their fury continues to live and flourish. What is this Jew whom they have never succeeded in enticing with all the enticements in the world? Says Leo Tolstoy, his conclusion, the Jew is the symbol of eternity. He is the one whom they were never able to destroy. Neither bloodbath nor affliction, neither the fire nor the sword succeeded in annihilating him. The Jew is eternal. He is the embodiment of eternity. Not the words of the Gemara, not a Jewish thinker, not a Jewish philosopher, a secular historian writing from one perspective, and that is objectivity. And when one objectively, with an open mind, studies this phenomena of this little tiny nation going from land to land and still existing as vibrant, as powerful as ever, it's a phenomena that's inexplicable according to any rational terms. One more, John Bedila, 19th century French author. In essence, the Jewish people chuckle at all forms of anti-Semitism. Think all you want, you'll not be able to find any one form of brutality or strategy that has not been used in warfare against the Jewish people. I cannot be defeated, said Judaism, and here are his words. This is an eternal people. This is an exalted and chosen nation. And my friends, I want to share something with you. Adolf Hitler in 1945, in May of 1945, when it was clear that Germany was defeated, he gave his final broadcast from a bunker deep underneath the ground because that was the only place that was safe for him. And his final address to the people sounded something like this. Above all, I charge the leaders of the nation and those under them to the scrupulous observance of the laws of race and to the merciless opposition to the universal poisoners of all people, international Jewry. On his deathbed, he went down with that vision. Hitler's vision was to set up a system of government that was to pave the way for generations to come. His Third Reich was to last 1,000 years. And ironically, where is he today? Where is the Third Reich today? And we, the sheep among the wolves, are the only ones still around to tell the tale, the only nation still intact of all the ancient nations. And you know what Reb Yonason Eifshitz says about this, his conclusion? He says, if a person studies Jewish history, they will see mofsim. They will see miracles beyond that of Yetzias Mitzrayim, greater than being able to witness Hashem taking the Jewish nation out of Egypt. If a person studies the Jewish history, watches them from exile to exile being miraculously saved, says Rabbi Yonason Eifshitz, they'll see a revelation of Hashem's hand greater than that which Hashem did in Mitzrayim. My friends, I believe that that is what Rashi's saying in Pshat Moshe Rabbeinu. Binu shnos dor v'dor means study. Study the generations. Look at Jewish history. See this phenomenon. You know what you're going to see? You're going to have a kasha that's unanswerable. You're going to look at it and say, wonders of wonders, what's going on? Why? Why does Hashem allow it to happen? But yet, apparently, He protects them. And you're going to be perplexed because there's such obvious hashkacha. Hashem is so involved, but yet He allows such things to happen. And when you see this wonder, the conclusion you'll reach is that there's a much greater destiny for this people than for any other people on this planet. And when you study Jewish history, what you're going to see is that the normal course of nature, the rules for every other nation, do not apply. And what you'll quickly see is that this nation has a very different destiny, a very different plan and purpose than any other nation. And you'll also quickly see something more amazing. And that is, time after time, when the Jewish nation follow the Torah, when they do what they're supposed to, they're exalted, they're mighty, they're high, they're untouchable. And when they start veering off, when they start assimilating, when they start mocking and imitating the ways of the Gentile nations amongst whom they live, they last for a little while, and then a ruach sa'ara, a powerful wind, sweeps over them, reminding them that they're Jewish, throwing them out, taking them out of that society, and rebuilding them in another place. Generation after generation, cycle after cycle, they land on some shores as a foreign people, return to their roots, the Torah reaffirms itself, then they get comfortable, they start assimilating, they start becoming like the Gentile nations, then a wind comes and sweeps them out. Again, they're foreigners in a foreign land. Again, they return to the Torah, and the cycle of history continues. And when you see this playing out time after time in every culture, in every type of society, and you go through all of the excuses that historians and secular philosophers like to give, the Jews are the scapegoats, the Jews had too much money, they were too poor, they had big noses, they had short noses, they were tall, they were fat, they were skinny, they were the workers, they were the capitalists, they were the communists. And you find that every excuse and every rationale is given, but none of them fit, none of them answer the question, and you're left with a tema. What's pshat? And if you're objective, and if you're honest, you quickly see that none of the answers fit, and there is only one answer. This is an exalted, mighty nation, guided by Hashem for a much greater plan, a much greater purpose than any other nation. And when they follow it, they're untouchable. And when they don't, they're oppressed. And if a person studies this, I think they see a tremendous chizik in Emunah. They see Hashem's hand in the Bria. They see Hashem running the world. And they come, exactly as Rashi says, to see that Hashem is quite capable, will bring them to the times of Mashiach, will bring them to Olam Haba. And it is a tremendous strengthening in a person's Emunah to study these events. But I feel that if you take all of the events of history, all of the events of the long exile we've been in, it all pales in comparison to one simple phenomena that has happened in the past 100 years. And that is, we, the Jewish nation, have found ourselves back in our own homeland. Something that's historically preposterous. It has never before and never will happen that an indigenous nation was kicked out of its land and somehow ended back in that very land, reconquering it, repopulating it, and building it up. Historically, what happens is a nation is kicked out, and then within 1, 2, 3 generations, they assimilate, they intermarry, they're no longer seen on the face of the planet. Not only have we existed for 1900 years in exile, not only have we wandered the globe, but we've ended up back in our very own land, repopulated it. And I think when you study that part, you see it's miraculous. You know what Palestine looked like in the 1880s? In the 1890s and the 1900s? Mark Twain was an adventurous sort of fellow. And he went on an adventure to see Palestine. And when he got there, he was shocked. He described it as an austere, barren wasteland, because that's all it was. It was desert, there was nothing. The city of Tel Aviv, one of the most powerful cities, certainly in Eretz Yisrael, but one that rivals many, many cities in Europe, was non-existent. Jaffa was a port city, and it wasn't a city, there were some shacks. You see the pictures from the 1890s, the 1900s, 1910, you see some shacks next to a pier. Tel Aviv was a dune, it was a sand dune a few miles down. And people began building shacks and they started putting up semi-houses. You go to Tel Aviv today and you see a metropolis. You see a powerful city with all of the infrastructure of a city. Roadways, sewers, electrical system. And when you turn on your cell phone, you find an amazing discovery that your cell phone works in Israel, which it doesn't in America. And what you find quickly is that Israeli technology is more advanced than its American counterparts. And you don't drop signals in Israel because it's just a better system. And the ultimate chutzpah, and this you have to appreciate, not only is Israel a developed nation in every sense of the word, they have done something that's so chutzpahdik that only Israel can do it. A tiny little nation of some 6 million people has sent up a satellite into space. China, a nation of 1 billion people, does that type of thing. But the technological advancement, all the sophisticated support systems that are needed for that are ridiculous for a nation as teeny as Israel to even begin thinking about. Yet not only has this little tiny nation regrown from nothing, from a desert, it's built up the most powerful, most advanced society in the region. And if you don't yet see that as wondrous and amazing, all you have to do is ask yourself, what was our welcome when we came back to our homeland? Our cousins did not exactly welcome us in with open arms. As a matter of fact, in 1948, when the Israeli nation was declared, my father was in America at the time, and my father told me that common wisdom had it that there was to be another Holocaust. They had just lived through Europe being decimated, and the assumption was that the Jews in Israel were to be next. Do you know what was going on at the time? There were 650,000 Jews living in Palestine, surrounded by 50 million Arabs. Azza Pasha, then the Secretary General of the Arab League, exclaimed over the airwaves, "This will be a war of extermination and a monumentous massacre," and that's what everyone expected. Because this little fledgling of a land was surrounded on every side by hostile armies. And you have to appreciate that the Israeli army was not very well developed on May 14th, 1948. Yet on May 15th, 1948, they were attacked. And Paul Johnson wrote an interesting book called The History of the Jews, and in it he details an interesting phenomenon. He says as follows: on May 14th, 1948, The state of Israel was declared. The next day, five mechanized armies attacked, each one alone sizably larger than the small band of Holocaust survivors defending Israel. The entire armament of the Israeli forces consisted of 17,000 rifles, 2,700 Sten guns, 1,000 machine guns, and 45,000 soldiers. 45,000 soldiers. You see, you have to understand, up until May 14, 1948, there was no Israeli army, no Israeli air force, and no Israeli navy. And the reason for that was quite obvious, because the British ruled Palestine. And the British had a very simple rule. If a Jew was found with a gun, he was arrested. So that means there were no drills, there were no marching, there were no machinations of an army. There were just some secret cells, the Haganah Met, the Irgun Met. They snuck guns in, they smuggled in guns. But the normal concept of drills and an army preparing was non-existent up until May 14, 1948. And the very next day, they were attacked by five fully developed, well-equipped, well-trained armies. And according to any rational assessment, the Jews should have been wiped out, driven into the sea. And to give you a sense of how ridiculous the fight is, not only were we underarmed, undermanned, and understaffed, we were surrounded on every side. Remember, if you fight a war on two fronts, you have to divide your forces. There was every single side of Israel was surrounded, including the sea. And amazingly, we won. But I want to give you an illustration just of how almost ridiculous the war was. When I was a kid, there was a book that I read called The Birth of the Israel Air Force. And this book detailed the Israeli Air Force on May 15th. The Israeli Air Force consisted of two Piper Cubs. Now, if you've ever seen a Piper Cub, Piper Cub is basically a go-kart with a propeller in the front. It's a one-seater. It's a rickety little flying trap. And there were two of them in Israel, hence they became the Israeli Air Force. Now, there were no gun racks. There were no machine guns. There were no bombs attached. The pilot would go up, and they'd put a case of grenades behind him. He'd fly low behind enemy lines, holding on to the steering wheel with one hand, with his other hand, pull out the grenade, pull out the pin with his teeth, and drop it on the Egyptian lines. And that's how we'd go run after run. And there's a story told that after a number of bombing missions, he comes back, and he asks for another case of grenades, and there were none left. They had none. So he thinks for a minute and he says, okay, bring me a case of soda bottles. Now his friends thought he had gone on one mission too many. And he said, no. He said, bring me a case of soda bottles. So he was serious. They brought him a case. They put it behind him. He flies up, flies very low behind the Egyptian line, drops the soda bottle. The soda bottle explodes. The Egyptians see the plane, hear the noise, and they run. A charming story. But in the real world, you don't win wars with soda bottles. Now, one more, because this was well annotated by Paul Johnson. There was a small kibbutz called Bet Eshel. Bet Eshel was in the Negev. It was actually 2 miles outside of Be'er Sheva. And there was a very well-equipped Egyptian army base that was right next to it. And the kibbutzniks understood that as soon as war would be declared, they would be the first point of contact. They dug shelters, they put up the sandbags, and they waited. They didn't have to wait long. They were very quickly surrounded by 700 infantrymen, by artillery, by jeeps, and a bitter, bitter battle ensued. For an entire month, the kibbutzniks held out. And the amazing part of the story was not that they bravely fought off the attack, but that after the battles, they took stock. The entire arsenal of the kibbutz consisted of 12 rifles and 2 machine guns. But the problem is, in the real world, you don't fight battles that way. In the real world, the mighty is victorious. The one that's better armed, better equipped, better trained for war wins the war, time after time, in every environment. And according to any rational assessment, there is no way that Israel should have existed. It shouldn't have existed then. It should not have existed after 56, nor after 67, nor after 73. And just to give you an illustration of how preposterous the history of the Israeli nation is? There's an article that appeared in the Ma'ariv on April 17th, 1983. The Ma'ariv is a very secular Israeli newspaper without a religious bent. And this was what the article says. Is this really how things happened? Just as they're told, this we are told in history books, that 650,000 Jews who escaped the horror of the Second World War and maintained their dignity amongst the British, did they really build up this whole infantry on their own efforts? Did they really create this nation state from nowhere? Says the Ma'ariv, by all logic and by all human reason, everything that happened in 1948 is in the category of the impossible. It was impossible with the limited arms that the Jews possessed, with the rudimentary international support that they managed to gather, with the limited resources that were available to them to do what they did. To run a war with no delineated front or rear lines, with no expert commanders to lead its battalions, the Ma'ariv's conclusion is that it's physically impossible, but yet it happened. Not ancient history, not 3,300 years ago, but within the context of modern history, within many of our memories. And I think there's a very, very powerful lesson to a Jew, to a thinking person, when they see this. There is a unique phenomena. There's something that is inexplicable by any rational terms, and what a person sees is the Yad Hashem. But I think there's an even bigger lesson. The Gemara in Gittin brings down that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was the leader of his generation, and he understood that the Churban Bayis was about to happen. And he leaves the city of Yerushalayim, and he asks for an audience with the Roman general Vespasian. And immediately Vespasian is taken with the wisdom and the aura of holiness that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai emits. And he says to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, what is your request? And amazingly, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai asks for three requests, the main of which was, Tein li Yavne v'chachameh, give me the Sanhedrin, you're going to destroy the city, you're going to destroy many Jews, do not touch the Sanhedrin, keep the 71 Chachamim alive. Josephus writes that approximately 1 million Jews died in the destruction of the first temple. No one understands that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was the father of that generation. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai understood that there were going to be countless numbers of widows, countless number of orphans, there was going to be untold bloodshed. You would think that of all the requests that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai would make, he would not be asking for Yavne v'chachameh, give me the wise men of the Sanhedrin. There are many, many other things that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai could and should be asking for. And yet he didn't. He asked for Yavne v'chachameh, give me the sages. And I believe the reason for that is quite obvious. And the reason for that is that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai understood that this was a moment in history. Because this was the first time that the Jewish nation were going to be exiled. The Jewish nation were going to be exiled from their land to be a foreign nation amongst powerful people. And as a foreign nation, what's typical is that you look up at the host country as progressive, as modern, as advanced, as powerful, and typically the exiled nation begins adopting the customs, the ways of the host nation, and he understood the danger very clearly. Because Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai understood that as long as the Jews keep the Torah, they're untouchable. But the minute they adopt the foreign ways, they'll be trampled underfoot like dust. And he understood the only way to ensure that there would be a Mesorah was that there should be Chachamim who would teach the younger generations, there'd be a transmission of Torah. Hence the key to Jewish survival was the Torah, was the Chachamim, Tein li Yavne v'chachameh, because that is the key to Jewish survival throughout the generations. And with that being said, anyone with any das in 1945 understood that Hitler was successful. Because while he did not succeed in killing out the body of the Jewish nation, he was successful in destroying Torah. In 1945, Torah was dead. The great yeshivas of Europe were decimated. The great rabbanim were killed. The great Rosh Hashivas won no longer. There was nothing left. You know what existed in America? In 1945, Ramoshe had a tiny little yeshiva on the Lower East Side. There were 20 men who sat around the table. There was a tiny little yeshiva called Torah Vadas. One or two other little places. In 1960, when Rav Aaron Kotler went to build his new building, and his good Balabatim came to him and said, Rosh Hashiva, what is the Rosh Hashiva thinking? That building is so huge. Why, there's room for 200 guys in that building. What in the world would the Rosh Hashiva need such a big building for? Because the concept of full-time learning, of real amelus b'Torah, of Masorah, was completely and utterly ridiculous to anyone assessing the situation in 1945. And yet today, in Lakewood, there are probably 3,000, maybe 4,000 young men learning full-time. Would you like to take account of Mir Yerushalayim? It's probably in the 4,000-5,000 range. Every street corner in Borough Park, every street corner in this nation seems to be filled with another yeshiva, with more guys learning, and Torah flourishes in our generation as it never has before. You know, they say since the great yeshivas of Sur and Pumbedisa, never have there been so many full-time learning people as there are now. Something that was so utterly out of hand, out of question 40, 50 years ago is a phenomenon that's flourishing right in front of our eyes. And I think there's another step that's equally remarkable. I try to daven when I can in Or Sameach because I find it a very, very emotional experience. And I remember one time davening Mincha, and after Shemoneh Esrei, I looked up. It was Kabbalah Shabbos time already, getting close. And I looked up and I saw the sun setting. But the problem was that I was looking through the earring hole in the fellow in front of me as I watched the sun set in that hole. It was so big. And this very fellow had tattoos on the back of his neck, tattoos on his hand, tattoos on his arms, wearing some very strange clothing with a very unusual haircut. There he was with a sitter davening. I saw the same fellow a number of months later. The earring hole was sewed up. The tattoos faded a bit. A few months after that, a regular haircut, a davening jacket. You know, one of those davening jackets with the footprint in the back, you know, right? Davening jacket, shuckling. A few months after that, the tattoos are almost gone. He looks like a regular yeshiva guy. I was with my son at this young man's ofruf when he got up to make the Birchas HaTorah, and he was a Ben Torah, marrying into a very chashuv family. But gentlemen, not only did he come from nothing, he was a very successful rock musician whose grandparents didn't have a clue. We're talking 3-4 generations of people who are so divorced from Judaism that they wouldn't know which side to hold a sitter from. And remarkably, it's not one person, but countless number of Bali Tshuva who are emerging from nowhere, from nothing. And I'll tell you a personal insight. To me, on a personal level, I can't tell you the emotions that I feel when I hear a fellow get up to daven for the Amud with a thick Russian accent. Because when he gets up to daven, what runs through my mind is Stalin rolling in his grave, the Kremlin tearing their hair out. Because what communism stood for 70 years, the great atheistic society, is now being unturned and undone. And you see Bali Tshuva coming from nowhere. And I think there's an interesting thought that runs through this. If you see a nation that has survived for 1900 years in exile through miracle after miracle, you see them being led on this unique path somehow it is that not only do they survive despite every attempt of man to annihilate them, not only do they survive, but they return to their land. Their land that was an austere, barren wasteland, and they rebuild a city, state, a nation that's powerful. A nation that was so outmanned against all odds, they win war after war. You see, the Torah that was clearly ended with World War II rebuilding. You see thousands upon thousands of B'nai Torah. You see Torah flourishing as it hasn't in centuries. And you see Bali Tshuva coming out of every part of the nation. And it doesn't take a very astute person to say, clearly, these are the times that were described by the Nevi'im as Ikva de Mashiach. And I once heard Rabbi Dvirutz make a very interesting observation. He says, all of the description of the Nevi'im, of all the horrible, barbaric events that are to transpire against the Jewish nation, all of it, with full measure, was meted out when you read some of the events of the Holocaust. And every barbaric, horrific scene was played out in full measure. And people make a mistake, Rabbi Dvirutz said, about Mashiach times. People assume that Mashiach means in an instant. There's a flash, a shofar blowing, the donkey, and the world changes radically. Rabbi Dvirutz says, if you read the way the Nevi'im, the Rishonim describe it, it's actually a gradual process. It's a slow, gradual changing. In fact, in Moshel Ma'adavadoma, if you go out at the very end of the evening, and you see it's pitch black, you look at the horizon, you see darkness, but it's a los, and there's a very slight rising, a very slight, you could see rays, not even rays, but it's just a little bit lighter, minute after minute, you don't even notice the difference, but slowly you're able to see, slowly it becomes more clear. Says Rabbi Dvirutz, that is the description of our times. You see, year after year, decade after decade, it becomes more clear and more clear. The signs are more obvious. All of the descriptions of the Nevi'im are being carried out. And you see us returning to our nation, returning to the Torah, returning to Hashem. And you see the Jewish nation reaching out for their ultimate destiny. When exactly is that moment? Only a Navi can tell us. But I think it's pretty obvious and pretty clear that these are the Ikva de Mashiach, the times of Mashiach. And I think that point is very, very important for us to understand. And it's very important for us as Jews to understand that Jewish history is the greatest revelation of Hashem's hand. And it's very important for us to study it and say, wow, not only is this a unique people, but they have a unique God who brings them step after step for their destiny. And they have a very particular plan and purpose, and that is to be the Am HaNivcha, the chosen nation, to be unique amongst the Gentiles, to be unique amongst the nations. And we are ot within a very, very hairbreadth away from the ultimate destiny, from the ultimate salvation. I want to close with a story. Rabbi Usher Wade, who was a Rebbe in Or Sameach in Yerushalayim for many years. The story begins when he was in an army base in Berlin in 1974, and he befriended a Jewish soldier there whose name was Stuart. And Stuart was not a religious fellow, yet one day Rabbi Wade saw him wearing a yarmulke. And he asked this Stuart, "What's pshat? Why are you wearing yarmulke?" And Stuart explained to him the story behind why he began wearing it. Stuart said, "We were engaged in a course taught by the course was called History of Military Tactics and Field Strategies. It was taught by a 3-star lieutenant general with a PhD in military strategy. And the course surveyed all of the major wars of history. During the last 2 weeks of the course, during the review, I raised my hand and I asked the general, why is it that we didn't survey any of the battle of the Jews? Not the ancient Jewish Roman wars, nor the modern Jewish Arab wars. Stuart said, the general, normally friendly, snapped at me, "Cadet, I'll see you after class in my office." Stuart described that the general brought him into his office, closed the door, locked it, sat him down, and said as follows, "Do not think that the staff at West Point has left the Jewish wars unnoticed," began the general. "We have examined them and analyzed them, and we do not teach them. Because according to military strategy and textbook tactics, the Jews should have lost them. You should have been swept into the dustbin of history long ago, but you were not. You won those wars against all odds and against all military strategies and logic. This past year, we hired a new junior instructor. During a private staff meeting and discussion, the Arab-Israeli wars came under discussion. We puzzled at how you won those wars. Suddenly, this junior instructor chirped up and jokingly said, 'Honorable gentlemen, it seems to be quite obvious how they are winning their wars. God is winning their wars.' The problem is, soldier, that nobody laughed. It seems to be an unwritten rule around here at West Point that God is winning your wars, but God does not fit into military textbooks. You are dismissed." Stuart said when he heard those words, he had never been so humiliated in his life. He said, "I have to come to West Point to learn about the greatness of my God from a non-practicing Presbyterian." He said he reached into his duffel bag, took out the yarmulke, put it on his head, and said, "This is where it will remain." And my friends, it is a very eye-opening statement that an objective, honest, critically honest person reaches. When they see this nation surviving, when they see this nation from exile to exile, when they see it continuing, they see Hashem. But when they see the rebirth, the regrowth, it's more than Hashem. They see the destiny, they see the plan, they see the ultimate greatness. And says Rashi, that is the ultimate chizik and emunah, and that is what we have to take from this lesson. We have to understand that these are the very last moments. There is a very great role for the Jewish nation. May HaKadosh Baruch Hu grant us the wisdom, the understanding, the ability to understand what we're here for. May we live up to that great challenge.
You've been listening to The Shmooze, presented by Teferis B'nai Torah. For more information on The Shmooze, please visit us at www.theshmooze.com, where you can download all The Shmoozing free of charge, as well as view source sheets and address questions or comments on this or any other Shmooze. The Shmooze is completely funded by private donations. We need your help to continue our work. All donations are tax deductible and count as miser. Please help us help others by calling 866-613-TORAH. That's 866-613-TORAH. Or you can make your donation right on the web at www.theshmooze.com.